In case you're wondering, that's a picture of one of the world's first desk calculators. It goes back to the 17th century. It was invented by Blaise Pascal. So the iPod has quite a long history. Okay, and we'll come back to that towards the end. I mean this in a perhaps unusual way and a very special way. We're all familiar with the fact that when things happen in mathematics, things happen in engineering and physics and science, the world changes, technologies develop, and our environment changes. That's a sort of an obvious thing. That's not what I mean. By change the world, I mean there are times in history when something has happened in mathematics that has changed the way people, at least people in the developed world, ordinary people, not technical people necessarily, everyone in the developed world thinks about life, lives their life, and does things, expects things, has tacit assumptions that have changed. There have been revolutions where if you go before a certain time, people's view of life was a certain way. They did certain kinds of things and so forth. Then that changed. Our ancestors' views of the world changed. Now the abstract for this talk suggests there's been four times when this has happened, one of them happening now. Now, if I'm talking about revolutions, it's actually rather hard to be sure that we're in the middle of a revolution. We're certainly in the middle of a communications revolution and all sorts of things that go with that. But it's really hard to tell. That's the judgment of history as to whether things have really changed. Because I definitely want to talk about revolutions. Revolutions being radical and pervasive changes in society and the social structure, in this case, driven by the very way we think about the world. Especially one made suddenly. I've greyed out the violence in hope, as much as anything, or a sudden, complete, or marked change in something. So that's what I'm going to be looking for, when something really major has happened to the way people think about life. Now, I said that, so it's what's going on in here that sort of somehow changed. Not necessarily this major structural changes, but just the way we encounter the world, the way we think about the world. So the fourth one is sort of somewhere in here, if it really is a revolution. It's certainly a technology revolution. But are we changing? I think we are, and I think the key one is actually this, the mobile phone, and the fact that we now accept the fact, and particularly our kids accept the fact, that you're connected with everybody else in your community and your friends all the time, whenever you are. You know, when you phone somebody up, you no longer say, who is it? You say, where are you? Which is a tremendous, that's a very different view of space and distance. And will that turn out to be a fundamental change in society? Who really knows? You know, from my perspective, my students' views of life and ways of doing things is very, very different from mine. You know, I've spent many hours playing video games to try and get a sense of what it's like to be young. What I've really learned is people my age are not very good video game players. But I actually did, as an educator, spend a lot of time trying to sort of get a sense of that. You know, I learned to type without using capital letters and to use abbreviations. So it may be that we're in a revolution. I really don't know. But I want to concentrate on the ones that happened previously, where we can say with some confidence, because we can look at the before and the after and say, yeah, things were different after than they were before. So we're going to go back to the first revolution, which is to do with the beginning of numbers. As a confirmed Macintosh user, it pleases me no end that that looks like a Windows PC. because Macintosh users think that the PC dates back roughly to that era. Is Microsoft a sponsor of this event, by the way? Counting. What do we know about counting? The first claim I'm going to make is that when our ancestors learned how to count, And numbers came on the scene, that the very appearance of numbers, a mathematical invention, literally changed the way people think about the world. Counting, we know, goes back at least 35,000 years, maybe longer. Numbers don't. We do know about numbers, but counting seems to go back 35,000 years. And that was essentially the use of physical tokens to record things. One can assume that piles of pebbles were used, but they tend not to persist as an archaeological record that's reliable, but we do have notches in bones, things scratched in stones and walls. There were presumably notches in wood, although that doesn't necessarily get preserved, but we do have enough artifacts for archaeologists and anthropologists to be able to decode almost what people were doing, keeping track of the seasons and the moon and so forth. Keeping track of numerical things, but without numbers. Having physical representations rather than abstract numbers. And then we get this step where numbers came into the picture, abstract numbers. And we've been able to nail that down pretty well to around 8,000 BCE in Sumeria. That's the use of physical tokens to compute. It began with physical tokens, but they were used to compute, and then those physical tokens gave way to abstract numbers. And it was an interesting story. It was put together a few years ago by someone whose image is going to come up in a minute. The evidence is that it was in this region, the so-called Fertile Crescent region, in the Sumerian civilization, around 8,000 BC, when this change took place. And what was going on? Well, it was essentially banking. The Sumerian society reached a stage of sophistication, if that's the right word, it's the word I'm going to use, a sufficient stage of sophistication, that they kept track of bartering, and they were essentially bankers, people who kept track of how much property you owned and how much you sold and bought. And so there was an organised society developing, and that created the need for an efficient way of keeping track of people's possessions. Okay, here's the person that came up with this really interesting evidence. This photograph taken in 1971, it's Denise Schmaltz-Besserat, an anthropologist at the University of Texas at Austin. She was there then, she's still there now. And she was doing some research in the Fertile Crescent region, and she came across various sites where she would find these little tokens, little clay tokens, different shapes with little things engraved on them, with sufficient regularity of patterns to realise that there was something systematic going on. And after sort of some time, she figured out that these were physical numbers, specific numbers. Now, they hadn't got to the stage of realising that five jars of oil and five bales of corn or whatever it is, or five asses and five oxen, they didn't get to the sense of realising that there was a fiveness that they had in common. Maybe they tacitly did that, but that hadn't been made explicit. So if you were measuring jars of oil, you would have one kind of token. You could have one jar of oil token or a second. In fact, some of them, you can figure out what they were keeping track of. That was probably jars of oil. It's a miniature jar. That looks like a goose, probably. Maybe that's geese. Maybe that's how many geese you owned. And some of them are more abstract. But you can sort of make guesses as to what was going on. So they had a physical counting tally system, more sophisticated than just notches on pieces of wood, but locked into the individual objects. Each set of objects in the world that was being counted had its own kind of numbers. Okay, so we had a system of keeping track of someone's worth in terms of a tally system of objects. And the banker's job was to keep track of your tallies so that the banker would say, how much do you own? How many sheep do you have and so forth? How many geese? And so there were people who keep track of that. How did they do that? How did they keep your bank account? Well, they would take your tokens, they would get a sheet of wet clay, rolled out clay, they would put your tokens into the clay, they would roll it around it and seal it up. So there, in a sealed ball of clay, nice and secure, you can see it going in there, is your bank account. If you want to trade with someone and there's going to be tokens, you're going to go along to the bank and the bank's going to take a hammer and they're going to break it open. This is the piggy bank method of banking. Break it open and move the tokens around. Okay? And then they get the clay back again and they reseal it. This is a good business to be in if you're a banker, because you're constantly being required to break them and redo them together. But after a while, people realised that there was an efficiency possible here. Because it's clearly, if you're doing a trade, okay, it maybe makes sense to break them and redo them, because you're going to move the tokens around anyway. But suppose you just want to check your bank balance. Make it apart. Did I ever pay someone to create another one? I'm sure they were on 15%, except they didn't have 15% yet. So it was said inefficiencies. Okay. So What they decided to do was, before they sealed up the clay, they would take the objects that were going to go into it, press them into the outside to make indentations, put them inside and seal it up. Wonderful! You don't need to break it apart to see what's inside, because you've got a record on the outside. Life was good. People lived for it. But then, of course, it didn't take them, actually did take them quite a while before someone realised, hang on a minute, if we have a record on the outside of what's on the inside, what's the role of the thing on the inside? Let's think. We've got sheep or geese in the real world. We've got tokens in the real world representing those sheep. And now we've got indentations representing the tokens. The middle bit is irrelevant. You can throw them away. Of course, you need to have one representative of each kind of token to make the indentation. So you don't need lots of geese token, you just need one to keep making the token. So you could throw away all except the ones you used to make the markings. You could throw those away. Those of you who remember the history of calculus will remember that wonderful phrase from Bishop Berkeley, the ghosts of recently departed quantities. Here we have some recently departed quantities, and they've left a ghost. What's the ghost of the five tokens of one kind that were inside? The number five. Numbers of ours has been what was left behind inside that clay envelope when the actual physical object was thrown away. Because the indentations on the outside denote what's on the inside. And if the objects have gone, you've just got three nothings been denoted. The nothings then been the nothings that pinned up the sheep or whatever. So numbers arose as what was left after the physical tokens were thrown away. The next step was to say, well, if we don't have the tokens inside, we don't need to make a ball at all, we just have a flat board. We can just have a clay tablet with indentations on it. So we now have an early precursor, maybe, of your bank balance, or maybe your credit card. It was just an abstract representation of your worth. And if you could understand what the symbols denoted, you would know at a glance what you owned. Nowadays, we need $3,000 worth of equipment to be able to decode what's in there. But it's the same principle. Okay. So then we've got numbers coming along. Think about the change that that made to humanity, in the sense of you no longer had to... First of all, you were no longer having to barter in terms of the actual things. You could barter in terms of the value of them. The value of your worth is measured in terms of these tokens. Trade essentially comes down to trading the tokens and then derivatively the objects. You can think of the world quantitatively in terms of abstract numbers. I would claim that that is a fundamental change in how we see the world, that we've got numbers. It's hard now, it's virtually impossible today, to imagine a world without numbers. It's virtually impossible. And yet before then there were no numbers. That, I think, is a totally fundamental change, since we can't imagine, it's so difficult to imagine doing anything without numbers being around, without the ability to talk about things abstractly. Boy, I mean, that's a fundamental change. And think of how we regularly now just go online and check our bank account, we transfer money. It's always from the parents to the kids, but that's the way it goes. I kept thinking that as I got older and my kids got older, the flow would come the other way. It still seems to be that way. But I can do it remotely. I can simply by changing sending some numbers around, in a sense, I can allow someone to buy a meal at the other end of the country. And I think that's what they're doing, actually. Okay, so we've got this abstract entity, this whole numerical structure that we can build the rest of society around. And that, I think, is a fundamental change. And everybody in the world now, in anything remotely approaching the developed world, numbers are pervasive. And they're part of our view of the world. Okay. How did you deal with numbers? Well, once you've got abstract numbers, you needed various ways of reckoning with the numbers, because you weren't shifting the objects around primarily, you were shifting the numbers around. And so there were various kinds of mechanical devices. The Romans had a kind of an abacus. There's the familiar Chinese abacus. And then there was a whole business of building and using different kinds of abacuses. And I like this particular card too, just to show that there's nothing really new under the sun. You could have big abacuses, smaller abacuses, or handheld abacuses. And in fact, many of the calculating devices weren't the sort of the wireframe abacuses, but they were just tables where people could move things around or put things down or scratch into sand and so forth. So a lot of them, this is a drawing of a Middle European reckoning table of the kind that was used. It's interesting to note that this was a technical profession. I mean, the bankers who were no longer cracking open clay envelopes had found something else to earn money with, because doing the calculations was difficult. You went to a professional to have the calculations done. And so all over Europe, there were these places where you could go and find people who could do calculations for you using one of these boards. Okay. Then something else happened. We came to a second revolution. And it was instigated, essentially, I mean, it's a long history here, but it was really at the beginning of the 13th century when Leonardo of Pisa, who might have looked like that, but probably didn't, because we have no idea what he looked like, and these are very recent things. That was actually a photograph I took when I went to see the statue in the Piazza di Miracoli in Pisa. That's a drawing that you can find all over the web. But these are very recent artist rendering. We've no idea what the guy looked like. In fact, we know very little about him, except the fact that in 1202, he wrote a book. The book was Liber Abaci. What that did was, it wasn't the first one, but it was the first one that was successful. This was a book that described how to do arithmetic the way we do it today. This was the beginning of modern arithmetic in what we call the Hindu-Arabic number systems. 1 through 9 and 0, place, position, how to do the calculations, line them up vertically, start at the units. In fact, he devotes the first 5 or 6 pages is devoted to explaining place number system, that there is a units column, a tens column, a hundreds column. And just think of that, 5 pages of dense pages? Does it really take 5 pages to explain that? Well, it does if no one has ever seen it before, if you haven't grown up with that around you. The system had been developed by the Indians in the period up to the 7th century AD. During that period, this was developed. It was then carried by the Muslim traders who took the spices and the dyes and the things from the Orient, went up in caravans up through Europe to the North African shore, and then traded predominantly through the Italian traders with Western Europe, or what was going to become Western Europe. So you've got this flow of traffic in both directions, and along with the spices and the various goods came this intellectual invention, this Hindu-Arabic number system. But it was regarded as something for the scholars. The academics thought this was neat, and they played with it. And some of them wrote a book. Some of the various people who wrote books about this, Al-Khwarizmi, the guy who gave us the name of algorithm, wrote a book about this. But it was a book for scholars. And then along comes Leonardo. Now, Leonardo, his father was a trader, and then later on a customs official. So Leonardo grows up in an environment of international trade. Pisa was one of the centres of trade in the Mediterranean. It was a hub. There was Pisa, there was Venice, a couple of others. But there were various places around doing this, but Pisa was one of the trading hubs. So he grows up in this environment where he's growing up knowing about international trade and commerce, and he can see it being done, and he knows that there are these people who do all of the calculations. His father no doubt uses one of these people. He travels to North Africa, where his father becomes stationed in the customs, as a customs officer. His father goes and is stationed in North Africa. And when his son is about 18, he invites his son over there, partly to complete his education. His son has already shown some prowess in mathematics. So he invites his son over there. So young Leonardo goes out there and starts to learn about this number system, this Hindu-Arabic number system. And he's fascinated by it and decides to write a book about it. And here's the difference. When Leonardo writes a book about it, he writes a book that can be read and used by the traders. It's an academic book. He's a mathematician. This is a solid mathematics book. He actually proves things. But when you look at it, his audience, his ultimate audience, is the traders.
What language did he write in?
This was Latin. Right. This was in Latin.
In fact, this is a manuscript. This is a photograph I had taken when I saw this. The weird thing about Italy is they've got so many ancient manuscripts. You can walk into the public library in Siena. This is just a book with a catalogue number. You can walk in. They do ask to see your passport. Actually, they take your passport from you. But then you sit down at a table, and they go and they bring this and they say, "Here's the book." And you pick up a 13th century manuscript, and you start to do that. It blew me away that I was allowed to do this. Now, you can't take photographs of it there. They do take the photographs for you. But this is just a book in the library in Siena. It's just one of many books. I was absolutely astounding when they did it. So this is in Latin. And it's huge. It's about 600 pages or more, this thing. This is a big, thick manuscript. It's bound now. It wasn't originally, but it's the original. So this is a 30. It wasn't. There's no copies that we know of that Leonardo wrote, or even from when he was alive. But this is within the same century. This was only 30 or 40 years after he died that this had finished being transcribed. So it's conceivable that he actually saw this individual copy. So we've got this, there is an English translation, I'll mention that in a minute. But you've got this book written with masses of examples. It is full of example after example of trading, measuring, converting units from the different denominations. And each individual city in Italy had its own number system, its own monetary system and so forth. So there were lots of things to convert. So it's all about arithmetic in a commercial environment. Leonardo was the Bill Gates of the 13th century. Okay, Bill Gates didn't invent computing. He didn't invent Windows-type operating systems. He really didn't invent anything. What did Bill Gates do? He saw, boy, if I can put these systems into the hands of everybody who wants one cheaply, that will be a big impact. And this is what he did. He put this into everybody's hands. It took a while to take. First of all, because it takes longer to make a copy of this than it does to copy a Windows operating system. But that's really what his key was. He was a solid mathematician, a good mathematician. Arguably not a great mathematician compared with some of the genuinely great ones, but certainly a good mathematician, one of the best of that century. But his real impact on history was being able to write a book that had huge impact because it gave the commercial people what they wanted. Once they'd learned this, they didn't have to have somebody else do their arithmetic for them. They could do it themselves. They could run their own company on their own. It really was just like the PC, the personal computer revolution. You don't have to read the Latin version because a few years ago, an English translation was done by a guy called Lawrence Siegler, who sadly passed away having finished the manuscript before the manuscript was published. There's some interesting stories about that that I'll save for another day. But this is the version I did, and you can buy this copy. You can buy this book from Springer. It's one of the dullest books I've ever looked at. It is 600 and something pages of just example after example after example. Today, this would not, no one would want to use this. You just wouldn't want to use this. People complain about calculus books. This is unbelievably dull, but this book changed everything. It had to be like that because he was trying to tell the world how to do their own arithmetic, how to learn about numbers. So here's the same reason it's a second revolution, because he's put numbers into everyone's hands. Now, the revolution actually didn't really finish until another guy from Pisa, Galileo Galilei, sometime later, sort of closed the loop, as it were, by showing that these numbers that were now around, everyone could sort of have, they had the symbols, they had the method for dealing with them. Once you've got these numbers, you can start applying them not just to commerce, but to the world around you, providing you create enough hooks to hang numbers onto things of the world. And what did Galileo? I'm using him as an icon. I mean, I've got various other people, but he's the one that's sort of most usually sort of identified with this. If you invent things and you give them names like temperature, force, mass, velocity, inertia, you can put names on things that you see in the world And you can measure them numerically. So you find things that you can hang numbers on in the world, and then, instead of doing what people previously did to try and understand the world, namely try and understand the sort of fundamental causes, how does one thing cause another, how does one thing relate to another, instead of trying to do science in a qualitative, relational sense, you can do it numerically. If you can attach numbers to things in the world, you can say, if I change this thing, by change, so the number changes, how does the number associated with that thing change? If I exert a greater force here, does this thing move faster? Is there a relationship between force and velocity, or maybe between force and acceleration? What happens if I change the size of the thing I'm trying to move? If you attach numbers to things in the world, you can measure how one thing affects the numbers related to another. You can look at numerical relationships. We now take it for granted that we, in fact, at the beginning when I walked in today, the room was very warm. So I went up to Ryan, who's one of the people behind the scenes here, and says, can we have the air conditioning increased a bit? And Ryan said, about 4 degrees? I said, that's probably about right. So this room is now 4 degrees cooler than it was when I walked in. What on earth does that mean, 4 degrees cooler? Well, it seemed reasonable to me. Ryan didn't have any trouble expecting. I didn't know what the temperature was, but 4 degrees seemed about right because I had a sense of what 4 degrees are. We communicated pretty precisely using numbers about the world. I don't really know what temperature is. I mean, I took physics, so I know it's about excitation of molecules and all that kind of thing, but I don't think I really know what. And I certainly don't know what force is. Does anyone know what force is? I don't think so. I can measure it. I mean, we've all measured it because we've learned how to do that in physics classes, but I don't really know what force is. It's a nice word that sounds impressive, and we can do lots of things with it. And this works because we can do things with it. But when you think about it, all of these things that we now regard as part of the world, force, mass, velocity, inertia, all of those kinds of things, which, by the way, in the early days, if you look at the days when this was going on, people were having a lot of trouble mixing up what was what. There was a lot of confusion. It took a while for this to sort of filter out. But we got, very quickly, in historical terms, we got used to the fact that we could think of our world numerically. And today, we don't just have numbers and arithmetic, but we think of the world through numbers, we use them to communicate, and we accept the fact that there's temperatures, that there's wind speeds, there's relative humidities. All of those things are part of our cognition. They're the way we encounter the world. They depend upon numbers and arithmetic, and indeed they depend upon the fact that we don't have to go to an expert to figure them out. If Ryan and I had to go to somebody else to figure out what happens, what 4 degrees meant, that would not be so effective. But it's part of our fabric. So with the very existence of numbers and they being able to compute, the fact that we all learn them, it's part of our childhood, that completely changes the way we view life. So that, I'm claiming, is the second revolution. And that's a fairly well-known one. We talk about the scientific revolution. We tend sometimes to overlook Leonardo, which was the beginning of it, but that's the second of these big revolutions. So the first one was numbers themselves and counting. The second one was precise numbers and counting, and being able to do it sufficiently accurately that you could attach it to lots of things in the world. And then there was another one that I actually, if I'd given this talk a year ago, I'd have said this was it. And what happened a year ago was, actually a little bit more than a year and a half ago, a publisher I'd worked with before came to me and said, we're doing a series of books on documents that change the course of history. Declaration of Independence, Magna Carta, the Bible, the Quran, the various documents that were written where you can say that document changed life on Earth, at least for a large part of the population, and ultimately for the whole population. So that was the idea of this book. It's a book series called Great Ideas. And he came to me, this is my editor, former editor Bill Fuck, and he said, still is my editor, and this is, he came and said, is there anything in mathematics like that? I've worked with him before in a couple of books, and I said, well, yeah, there is actually. I don't know much about it, but there is something that would be ideal. It's all to do with predicting the future. Okay? What's going to happen tomorrow? Not predicting the future with a crystal ball, but predicting the future with numbers. There was a period in history when our conception of the future really did change. Instead of a crystal ball, we can crunch numbers
to tell us about the future. And we know exactly when that change took place. This isn't a maybe it began in 1202 and ended in the 16th century. Because on a particular day, Monday, August the 24th, 1655, it was a Monday. Blaise Pascal, remember the picture at the beginning, sent a letter to Pierre de Fermat in which he explained, or at least in which he summarised, a certain way of doing a calculation to calculate the odds in a certain game of dice. Now, I've taken courses on probability theory, and every course I've taken to, the professor, right at the beginning, says, this goes back to a letter from Pascal to Fermat sometime in the 17th century. And I've given courses on probability, and I have also said to a group of wide-eyed students, this all goes back to a letter, you know, it's one of these stories we like to tell. Had I ever looked at the letter? No. Did I know anything about the story? No, I was just passing it on because it was a nice way, I thought, to give a bit of historical context to a subject that was going to really tax people's intellect within about 20 minutes. So, okay, so that was what was going on there. But now I've got a book contract, and the cheque had arrived, so I was obliged to actually write the book. So I went and looked at this stuff. I was absolutely staggered by this story. This is one of the greatest stories I've ever read, and I didn't know about it. Here's how the letter begins. It was in French, but here's a translation into English, and I'll just read a little bit of it. It's a long letter. It's many pages long, but I'll read the beginning. So this is Monday, August the 24th, 1654. Monsieur, that's the only part that I'll leave in French. It's almost the extent of my French, so that's fine. I was not able to tell you my entire thoughts regarding the problem of the points by the last post. And at the same time, I have a certain reluctance at doing it, for fear lest this admirable harmony which obtains between us, and which is so deep, academics don't do this anymore, but they were very polite in those days, and which is so dear to me, should begin to flag. For I am afraid that we may have different opinions on this subject. Wait a minute, isn't this mathematics? Different opinions on this subject? Ooh. I wish to lay my whole reasoning before you, and to have you do me the favour to set me straight, isn't that a nice way of putting it, to set me straight if I am in error, or to endorse me if I am correct. I ask you this in all faith and sincerity, for I am not certain even that you will be on my side. Now, was this a really difficult mathematical problem? Not to us it wasn't. The problem we're going to see in a minute is one that I would happily give at the end of the first lecture on a first year undergraduate course in probability theory, and many of the students will get it right. We've got two of the greatest mathematical minds of the 17th century having different opinions, not even be sure if they've got it right. When two great minds are having trouble with something that today we would regard as a simple little exercise for students, something big is going on in human society. Okay, what was the problem of the points? Well,
the problem that piqued Pascal and Fermat's interest revolved around a game of dice that comes to an untimely end.
Suppose two people are playing a game, they're gambling with each other, and halfway through the game they have to abandon it. One person is ahead of the other person at that stage. Question, how do they divide the pot so that it's fair to both? Now, if you think about it, that means you have to look into the future, the potential future that would have happened had they been able to complete the game.
In a series of letters, Pascal and Fermat imagined a game of dice to be played in five rounds. The first person to win three rounds wins the game. In their scenario, they imagined that Fermat was ahead two rounds to one. Fermat just needs one more round to win. Next, the mathematicians looked at all the possible outcomes. For example, If Fermat won rounds 4 and 5, he would win the game because he would have won at least 3 of 5 rounds. If Fermat won round 4 and lost round 5, then he'd win again, because again, he won 3 of 5 rounds. If Fermat lost round 4 and won round 5, he'd still win. In fact, the only way for Fermat to lose would be if he lost both of the last 2 rounds. Given these possible outcomes, Fermat and Pascal correctly reasoned the odds were 3-1 in favor of Fermat. Therefore, Fermat should get 3/4 of the pot and Pascal 1/4. The mathematicians calculated how a slight edge would result in one player winning more often than not.
Okay, this was a clip taken from a series made in the middle of the 1990s, funded by Texas Instruments and the National Science Foundation, called Life by the Numbers. And a couple of reasons I use this. First of all, you know, it's a neat explanation. Secondly, what's difficult about that? And thirdly, we were so confident that this was not difficult to understand that we were happy to put that in the middle of a programme for broadcast television. Now, obviously, it was PBS, so you had a somewhat selective audience, but it was still broadcast television. And we didn't want to lose the audience. We'd spent $4 million on this series. Nobody wanted to lose that audience. And so we had to be confident that this would be understandable by people just sitting down and watching the TV. We had no worries. Again, we sort of tested this on people. The TV station tested this on people. A lot of people looked at it and they said, yeah, I understand that. That's no big deal. But wait a minute. If today we can put something forward and explain it so that not only do mathematics students have no trouble understanding it, but an ordinary person sitting there can follow the reasoning, how come Blaise Pascal and Fermat, Pierre de Fermat, how come it took them, that one letter, by the way, was in the middle of a correspondence. It's the one letter where the answer was found and summarised. Why did it take so long and so much difficulty to figure it out? Well, it seems easy today because we grew up in a world where this happens all the time. We turn on the TV, the chances of rain tomorrow are 19%, or no, that's it, 20%, 35%, so forth. We look at the baseball statistics. We are surrounded by statistics, by probabilities. We buy insurance. We do a whole bunch of things based on calculating probabilities about the future. It's part of the world we live in. We know that life is risky, but only a certain amount of risk in life. Ordinary people today can buy houses and automobiles and things, even though in a sense they don't have the money for them, because other people with the money can calculate the likelihood of defaults, things going wrong, they can buy insurance, insurance companies can make money. Other people can make money reliably out of laying off the things, chances of things going wrong. So before then, who could afford to buy property or to send items across the ocean? People that were either very wealthy or very, very brave and foolhardy and risky and risk-type people. Ordinary people couldn't do that. There was no way you could do that. Once you could manage risk by being able to calculate the precise probabilities of things happening in the future, that changes life for everybody. Because lots of things become possible and doable, because the risk hasn't been eliminated, but it's been laid off and quantified, and you can measure what exactly your risk is, or other people can measure it for you. So we grew up in a world today where risk management is part of the fabric. We are used to the fact that we can do certain risky things. You know, aircraft are in the sky, and occasionally they fall out of the sky and people die, so there is a risk. But we can calculate the risk, and we do calculate the risk, and we know how low it is. Actually, we know how low the airlines tell us it is, and we just trust that they're right. But the fact is, you can do these calculations.
back in the 17th century, not only did they not know how to do a calculation, many people thought it was impossible. And if you don't think something's possible, no matter how smart you are, you're going to find it almost impossible to do it. Almost any mathematician who solved a major problem will tell you a lot of the reason it took them so long was they thought they were trying to do something that wasn't possible. Afterwards, you look back and you think, and actually that's true even, for, you know, I never solved a great problem, but I thought I solved some problems, and afterwards I always thought, why did that take me a couple of years to solve? Because looking back, it sort of seems obvious, but it sure wasn't obvious 2 years ago, and in fact, any mathematician looking at a research problem is constantly plagued by the doubts. I might be trying to prove something that's not possible. I might be trying to do the impossible. And not knowing something's possible is a huge psychological barrier. So we can actually understand why Pascal and Fermat took so much time about it, because they grew up in a society where this was thought to be not possible. The future was a matter in the hands of the gods, as they would say. Things would happen. The word probability was around, but it really meant uncertainty, not knowing about something.
Yeah.
So that's why, because they were struggling to understand this thing, Pascal lays out the letter at the beginning with all of these disclaimers, saying, I'm really not sure about this, we're disagreeing, because the correspondence they'd had, and this was a 6 or 7 letters into the correspondence, ideas had been passing back and forth, and they clearly had different ideas of how to do it. They were getting different answers, and Pascal in particular was getting different answers from one letter to the next. And not because he was stupid, he was really very smart, but he was trying to do something that hadn't been done, feeling that it wasn't possible to do. The history of the problem itself, it first appears in a book published in 1494, but it's known that the problem was around before. And no one knows where this problem really began, but it was certainly published by Pacioli in 1494. He was a good mathematician, certainly a very good mathematician, tried to solve it, wasn't able to. But this is the same problem. Danny Glover just told us how to solve it. Right? He's a movie star. and he was able to solve it. Actually, he wasn't able to solve it, but he's a good actor. So, I could solve it, but they didn't want me in front of the camera because I don't look like Danny Glover. Cardano, who did some incredible stuff in what we now call probability, he was the guy who figured out that if you have two independent events, you multiply probabilities. So they were struggling with the idea of predicting the future, not in the world, in the gambling table, at the gambling table in the gaming rooms. This was all done, it was fueled by gambling. You know, if you look at history, many of the great, actually most of the great inventions are fueled either by military conflict or by entertainment. It's one of those two things. You know, microchips were essentially fueled by the Cold War and the space race, and then they were developed by the gaming industry, and to some extent by the movie industry, not by academics wanting to do clever calculations. Okay. He tried, failed. Tartaglia, another famous name from the history of mathematics, he looked at it and said, you can't do this. You simply cannot predict how that game might have come out numerically. Another well-known mathematician, not so well-known, but certainly a prominent mathematician of the time, Forestani, claimed it was impossible. Then this guy, the Chevalier de Merret, looked at it. He was a keen gambler, was intrigued by it, and he was a friend of Pascal, so he asked Pascal. And Pascal thought about it and said, yeah, I'm going to contact Fermat, who we had never, these two guys had never met as far as we know. In fact, we do know they hadn't met. But he knew of him. Fermat was regarded as the most powerful mathematician around at the time. Okay. And yet, so these guys write that letter. Okay. He approaches Pascal, the correspondence takes place. During the course of that correspondence, they figure it out. Essentially, it was Fermat that figured it out. That solution we just saw was Fermat's solution. The one we actually saw in the video, that was Fermat's solution. But when Fermat wrote to Pascal about it, Pascal didn't understand it, and actually kept that, his whole letter is sort of saying, well, I really don't understand this detail, I don't understand that detail. It was mired in confusion. It looks much more simple now, because that little video clip was created in the 20th century. after we've been known how to calculate probabilities for a long time. And it was relatively easy to do it. In those days, if you look at the correspondence, it's easy to understand what was difficult about it. And yet, within 3 years, modern probability, something that looks exactly the same as you'd find in a probability book today, had been established. It took just 3 years after that letter, and we have modern probability theory as it looks today, including the notion of expectation, the sort of the weighted likelihood of something happening, which is how you make calculations and judgments about the future. Short time after that, a somewhat independent event took place. John Gaunt in London analysed mortality tables and essentially began modern actuarial science, statistics, collecting data and making inferences with the data. Because what's happening now is a piece of mathematics developed to help predict what's happening when you roll dice in a gaming room was about to go worldwide in the real world. Not just for predicting what happens in the gaming room, but for predicting what happens in the real world. Now, in the gaming room, there's various, you can calculate likelihoods of dice rolling on one side. And that was known before that correspondence. They knew that there was a sort of a 1 in 6 chance, in some sense, of something happening. That was all sort of known. But once we had this method of dealing with probabilities that was developed by Pascal and Fermat for that particular game, the problem of the points, within a few years, this was going to go out into the world. And in the world, if you want to apply probability theory, you need to have some data on which to infer things. You need to have calculations of relative frequencies of something. Okay. The equivalent of knowing that a die will come face six up at 1 in 6 times if you roll it often enough. Okay, so Gaunt begins the process of been collecting and reasoning with data. A short while afterwards, Huygens, known primarily as a physicist, I guess, uses that idea to take it much further, uses the probability theory explicitly to take those calculations or those inferences of Gaunt and make them much more systematic. And then a guy who at the time was the Prime Minister of Holland, Jan de Witt, I think he was the youngest Prime Minister they've ever had. He was a Prime Minister at about 20 or 21 years of age or something, which he had to because he was killed in his early 20s. They were kind of brutal with prime ministers in those days. You know, if you didn't cut it, or you got into a war, that was the end of it. Now we just impeach. But in those days, they just killed you. Okay. Short period afterwards, we have very accurate annuities pricing based on Gaunt's figures. Again, we're in the same century still. 1693, Edmund Halley got some more precise mortality figures from Breslau and was able to calculate much more accurate mortality figures so that you could insure people's lives, so people could sort of figure out the likelihood of someone dying before a certain age. Beginning of the next century, we have Nicolas Bernoulli, a member of the very famous mathematical Swiss family, coming along, showing how you could apply this new theory in the law courts. For example, one of the questions was, if someone disappears, how long do you have to leave it before you can declare them dead so that the inheritance can be passed on? So you needed to be able to calculate in a legally precise way, a manner that the court would accept, when it was acceptable to declare that someone was dead. And that was one of the problems that was dealt with here. So there was issues of the mathematics in the law courts. By the way, probability theory is still front and foremost in the law courts. There are cases here in DC in the Court of Appeals which have been in the Court of Appeals now for many years because people don't know how to calculate the probabilities. It's all to do with DNA profile identification. And there's a big argument, particularly in DC and in California in the Courts of Appeals, as to how do you calculate the probabilities that a DNA profile identification is reliable. You might think the statisticians and the probability theorists all agree on how to do it. We do not. I say we, I'm not one of them. I'm not that one. But the experts disagree. They fall into two camps. One camp says, this is how you calculate the probability that a DNA profile really does identify the criminal. And the other group says, no, you have to calculate this different way. And what's at issue is, you have a DNA profile identification. Now that's not an identification of someone's DNA. That's a sequence of 13 numbers. The FBI uses what they call a 13 sequence identifier. Your DNA identification that's used by the FBI and various authorities is 13 specific markers on the DNA sequence, to each of which is attached a number. So it's basically a sequence of 13 numbers. That's your DNA identification. Now, the chances of two randomly selected people sharing the same coordinate number is about 1 in 10. So the chances of a match on all 13 is about 1 over 10 to the 13. Unfortunately, DNA profiles are usually not as clean as that. You've only got 7 or 8 of them that match and the bits of others. So the numbers begin to creep down, and they creep down sufficiently far that it actually makes a difference as to how you calculate them. Unfortunately, the experts disagree fundamentally as to how you calculate the probability in those circumstances. It's a fairly complicated story. At least it seems complicated to us. On the other hand, Pascal and Fermat would have thought it was pretty darn complicated to do even the things that we take for granted. So this hasn't gone away. This is not something in history. This is something that's front and foremost now in our legal system. How's the right way to calculate probability theories? So we might think we've made progress, and of course we have, but we still have problems knowing which is the right way to do a calculation. Okay, going back to the historical development, the modern use of the word probability was by another Bernoulli, Jacob Bernoulli, in his book The Art of Conjecture, which means precise conjecture, numerical conjecture. And in fact, he distinguished between different kinds of probabilities, the kind of probabilities you get when you're rolling dice, where you can actually, by thinking about the game, say, well, it's 1 over 6 times 1 over 6 sort of things, and probabilities in the real world that depend upon calculating, depend upon collecting data. So he explicitly distinguished between gambling probabilities, which are very precisely calculable, and probabilities based on data from the real world. It was he that proved the law of large numbers that says if you want to get a reasonable assessment of what the population thinks, the more people you ask, the more reliable the answer is. You don't ask 10 people, ask 1,000 people, and try to ask 1,000 randomly selected people. So that was sort of the basic idea of modern market polling. Kind of thing. Still, relatively soon after 1654, less than 100 years later, we've got the bell curve coming in, the idea of how we understand data and the dispersion of data, and then 1764, just over 100 years later, we've got Bayes proving his, or posthumously published, Bayes proving the theorem that Homeland Security now uses to decide whether it's an orange day or a red day. Our lives now depend upon this in many, many ways. I mean, the moment you switch on your computer, Bayes' theorem is at work doing stuff. And it's used by the military, businesses, Homeland Security, Defense Department. I mean, this is big, big time stuff. That's within 100 years. Boy, did things happen fast. That's a revolution. And it's a revolution, and it changes the conception of the future. The future, yeah, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but we take it for granted that tomorrow comes with probabilities and numbers. We're familiar with the numbers because of previous revolutions. We're familiar with calculating with them because another revolution. So those two revolutions have been rolled into a third one that we now accept that tomorrow comes with numbers. And it comes so with numbers so reliably that we know when we're doing something risky, when we're not doing something risky, we know how we can take insurance. We live our lives now knowing that the future actually is pretty predictable. It's pretty damn predictable. You know, stuff happens, but only exceptionally. Most of the time, it works. And so that's the way we view life now. Life is not viewed as random. Tomorrow is not purely random. We know roughly what's going to happen. In fact, more than roughly, we can very often attach numbers. That's a fundamentally different way of living your life. The future is not completely arbitrary. It comes with numbers, and you have a sense of those numbers. The letter concludes, and this was the letter that did it. If you look at that letter, I'll say one other thing as well about that letter. It's worth reading the letter because, and it's particularly worth reading the letter if you're a student, because when you're a student, you get this impression that there are people out there called mathematicians for whom this is easy. And there are great mathematicians for whom it's unbelievably easy, but you're a poor mortal and this doesn't make sense to you. You should read that letter and see how Pascal struggled with stuff that we would regard as, well, duh, what do you think you should do? Pascal is really struggling with that. Fermat wasn't. Fermat actually was rather unusual. As far as we can tell, as far as you can tell from this letter, Fermat pretty quickly figured out the answer. He was a very unusual, he's one of the best seven or eight mathematicians of all time, I would say. He quickly figured it out. But Pascal, who was a really damn good mathematician, justifiably famous, he had a lot of trouble with that proof. And you should read his words and see how he struggles with it. And realise that mathematicians, by and large, maybe the Fermats are the exception, but maybe there's only seven or eight of those in history. The rest of mathematicians are not people for whom mathematics comes easy. They're people who keep struggling until they get it. And Pascal struggles and struggles and struggles. And even when he's got it, he's not really sure that he's got it. And he ends his letter, these monsieur, this is several pages afterwards, are my reflections on this topic, on which I have no advantage over you, except that of having meditated on it longer. Because Pascal had thought about this for a while before he contacted Fermat. But this is of little advantage to me, that's like change, from your point of view, since your first glance is more penetrating than any of my prolonged endeavours. He recognises at the end that he's up against a much better intellect. And he's pretty darn sure that Fermat is right. But he's not entirely sure. If you read the letter, he's still not really sure in the letter. Goes on a little, I beg you to inform me how you will proceed in your research on this problem. I shall receive your reply with respect and joy, even if your opinions should be contrary to mine. He still doesn't totally buy it. In fact, he doesn't understand the proof. He acknowledges that Fermat seems to be much smarter and probably is right, but he doesn't know why Fermat's right. He doesn't know why he's wrong. He doesn't know why he's wrong. Contrary to mine, I am, etc. It's an incredible letter to read. I was actually, as an educator, this blew me away. Because here's one of the greatest mathematical minds of all times, looking no different from myself as a student or any other student I've come across. It's very, very rare to have someone can see the answer. Pascal wasn't great because he saw the answer. He was great because he kept on and on and on. So the letter is one of the greatest examples I've come across as an example of the secret to mathematics, you just keep plugging away until it makes sense. And at the end of the correspondence, if you read the other letters, then you know, he eventually sort of gets the hang of it. But at this stage, he bows to authority because he can recognise that Fermat is much smarter in this kind of calculation, but he still doesn't understand the answer. Okay, if you want to know more, there's a book coming out at the end. When you invite an author, sooner or later, there's going to be a book commercial, and this is the book. It's a short book, it's only 80 pages long, or thereabouts. The Unfinished Game, Pascal Fermat, and the 17th century letter that made the world modern. That's coming out in a few months' time. The entire letter is published in there with some other correspondence between them and all of the historical stuff. It's a short book because it's actually a short story. It took place in a very short space of time. But that's a revolution. When life changes over the space of 100 years, in fact over the space of 5 or 6 years essentially, that to my mind is a revolution. And it was a revolution that created the world in which we live today. Thank you.